The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfesh.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Kim Drobes, in for Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Just ahead on the program, Atlanta-based photographer and educator Toki Rome Taylor discusses her new exhibition, Insight, The Body as Artifact, Archive, and Memory. And later in the program, our series Speaking of Comedy highlights local comedian Mike Schatz. But first, when the story broke last summer that new development was coming to Ponce de Leon Avenue, just up the block from Ponce City Market, many Atlantans began to mourn the loss of some beloved restaurants and bars. Questions were raised about the future of places like The Local, Friends, The Drunken Unicorn, and the iconic dance palace known as MJQ Concourse. 2023 marks the 25th and final year that MJQ will occupy 736 Ponce. However, it was recently announced that the dance party will continue and MJQ will move to Underground Atlanta. The club will take over the vacant spot that was once Dante's Down the Hatch. Here to discuss their upcoming move into one of our city's most unusual spaces are MJQ co-owners Murphy and Ryan Purcell. Welcome to City Lights.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
For the unfamiliar, Murphy, would you share a bit of the history of the club and describe the vibe?
Oh, wow. It's where you go to dance. It's where you go to have fun. It's where to go to just let the week pass away kind of thing. It's not a place to, you know, sport your expensive cars or anything else. It's a place to like really just let it all out. And it's been that way since the 90s.
How did you end up developing such a diverse clientele?
By not trying to. I think the more you try and really hone in on a certain demographic or, you know, anything over the years, we've learned like just play what's fun, play what people want to hear, what people don't know about yet and are going to want to hear soon. And just and really try not to overthink anything. Just have fun.
Yeah. From the street, MJQ is very understated. Ryan, can you describe what it's like walking into MJQ as it currently stands?
Walking up to MJQ, I think people don't even know that they're walking up to it half the time. If you're new to the venue, I couldn't tell you how many times people will walk past it, walk to another place. It's not what you expect at all whatsoever. It's a shed on top of a...
It looks like an admissions place, yeah.
Like, it's a shed on top of an old parking garage that you walk down a dark walkway into, and it opens up into this underground wonderland of music and fun and dancing. And, you know, sometimes I'll stand outside and I can tell who's new, because while they're standing in line, they'll step out and try to peek down this doorway to see what they're about to walk into, which is always entertaining. And those are usually the people that I'll walk over and I go, is this your first time? And, you know, like, what brought you, you know, kind of just start talking to them, because I'm always interested to know, like, you've never been here. Like, where are you from? Like, how did you hear about it? And what you're about to walk into is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, if you look on the outside, it's like a little green shack, and people go like, wait, where's the nightclub? I'm like, oh, not unlike the TARDIS. It's bigger on the inside. Trust me, there's more to do in there.
Well, for both of you, when you first learned about the upcoming development to Ponce, did you consider marking the end of the MJQ era, or did you immediately know that you wanted to find a new location?
We both knew that it was something that we wanted to live on. For me personally, it was something that I had only come into ownership of MJQ maybe not even a year before the announcement. So it was this kind of surreal to where, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm part of this, you know, this amazing establishment that I've been going to for many, many years and helping to develop the brand and the sound and the parties. And then, you know, being told that there's a chance that it's just not going to happen anymore was a bit overwhelming. But after talking to Murphy, which I'm sure that he will say, it's not an option. You know, like, yeah. We have to keep going.
The show must go on. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, yeah. Also, I just from both of our angles coming at it, I've been here since MJQ has been here since we moved to the 736 in the 90s. So it was a matter of like, no, I want this to keep going. I'm not done yet, you know, but I wanted to keep it going as opposed to like, you know, Ryan had really just started putting his mark on the place. And it's great too. Like so many great changes that he's been putting in. And I wanted to see that keep going because, you know, for the first time, I was like, oh, this is like really exciting what he wants to do. And like, you know, having a new place to go to that we can really put our mark on, I think is going to be great.
I think with the two of us, it was a lot of, I don't know if sadness is necessarily the word, but feeling beat down is definitely probably a better way to put it. But when we had walked into where we are now moving into, I think that was the moment when the two of us finally kind of looked at each other and we go, okay, we're doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Like this is like, without a doubt, it's living on.
Had you looked at any other spaces before you went to Dante's?
So this, to me, this is a completely new venture in my wheelhouse. I did start, you know, driving around and Murphy and I started kind of talking about all of these places. You know, it's just with the way things are going right now, the size of the place that we're in, and you obviously want to try to hold on to the Atlanta mailing address. And it's overwhelming. I mean, at first, I think we were trying to look at places to purchase, which we've quickly realized that was not going to be obtainable for us. And so we kind of started looking around at rental places. You know, we were kind of throwing around the idea of taking over the Camellis and Little Five Points, but I've gone there a bunch. So I'm like, I don't know, like, you know, it's like, it's not underground. Like it's two levels. Like the top level could be kind of cool. We have to rip out the kitchen. Like it's just all of these like logistics of thinking of that. And then Portman, who's actually buying the developers that are buying this property, you know, they were like, can we help you out at all? And I know of this cool space. And we just kind of started talking about a mortuary in Midtown.
Oh my gosh.
Which I was kind of excited about too, you know. But when I think I kind of pressed on it and tried to talk to them a bit more about it, they had found out that the owners of the actual property were looking for a more short-term tenants, and so that was really not much of a fit for us either. And it was really, I think, when Underground had reached out to us, we were like, sure, you know, like, I mean, you hear about Underground, and I've lived here long enough, and Murphy's certainly lived here long enough to where we've seen Underground go through, or at least try to go through, these changes over and over again. And we're like, yeah, you know, always say yes, you know, like we'll come by, we'll come check it out, see what you're doing. And that's when we kind of started. We saw the space and it was great, but I think, you know, but hearing their plans and seeing what they already had in motion is kind of what solidified it for us.
And when you say that, you mean Underground in general and all of the changes that are happening there?
Correct. So it was already kind of exciting to think about being close to our neighbor again, the Masquerade. You know, I can't tell you how many times, even just for me in general, like I would go to a show and we're like, all right, well, let's go to MJQ now. And so people could start to do that again. I think I've already seen a lot of comments of people being excited about going to shows and ending their night at MJQ again. So I love that that is, without even having to say, that's where people's mindset are already going. And shortly after when we started talking about the lease, we had found out that another one of our neighbors is going to be our neighbor once again, which is Paris en Ponce. They're going under a new name, but leaning more into their La Maison Rouge kind of idea. So you're going to see an announcement about that pretty soon. So that's really exciting for us as well.
That's wonderful.
But I think just seeing,
we saw a sneak peek of it. We poked our head in, and that place is going to look amazing as well.
Oh my gosh. Beautiful, really cool space. Yeah. The railing that looks very, you know, like old French style, this kind of red light district vibe. It's going to be really cool.
Wow.
So I think, you know, I mean, it's great to, you know, to kind of have family, you know, next to you again. But also just seeing like what they're doing and the plans of what they have over the next 5 years and 10 years and the fact that they reached out to us and they are kind of being this island of misfit toys for all the people that are getting pushed out in the city and be like, yes, like, please come to Underground. This is a place that we can escape to and continue doing what the city of Atlanta loves.
Are there any challenges that the location of Underground presents?
I mean, I would say just the fact that downtown has been so, you know, needing an upgrade, I would say, for the longest time. So there's still a lot of people that have that kind of, oh, it's downtown. You know, we don't really have a downtown unless it's Labor Day weekend and you're at Dragon Con. No one really thinks to go to, you know, to downtown, but that is definitely, I think, going to be changing. You know, people are going to be moving there. The Gulch is going to be developed into, I think, some more housing, some more residential and whatnot. And I think, honestly, these guys are on the right path of, like, you know, the same way if you go to like a neighborhood in anywhere in Atlanta over the past bunch of years, like West Side or Ponce de Leon when we first moved here, or East Atlanta, or all these places where, like, you know, there was nothing really going on. So they would move in a couple of cool, like they let the cool kids move in, like, you know, the artists and some nightclubs and bars and whatnot, and let it kind of simmer for a minute and let people go like, oh, this is fun. Let's hang out here. And then, you know, high rises move in. So I think in a lot of ways, like Underground is kind of doing that same thing where, like, letting the cool kids move in, like, let the place be fun. And then, you know, like, let people kind of go, oh yeah, we can actually go downtown and have a night out kind of thing. So
I think also to touch base on what Murphy's saying is that it is a really good thing. And obviously there's going to be more development, you know, with Underground and growth and change, not just around, but actually at Underground. I think everybody has this connotation of what Underground is because everyone's been trying to bring it back to life for so long, but I am so appreciative of them reaching out and letting us be part of this, because before, you know, like, instead of trying to jump on the bandwagon later on, like being there in the beginning. And I mean, I've gone to a couple of city meetings and, you know, it's kind of the phrase has been thrown around that this is going to be Atlanta's nightlife hub now.
Once upon a time, that was true as well. It's fascinating to see the course that Underground's taken over the last 50 years. It really is. So let's talk about Dante's particularly. What an iconic and unusual space you guys have chosen. I read in the AJC something about the fact that you couldn't go further underground, you thought, than where you were at the MJQ parking garage. And yet you have found this space.
If we go any lower, we're going to have to sin harder. That's how far down we've gone.
I mean, going from under a hotel to underground, like, yeah.
So what were your first thoughts when you walked into the old Dante space?
I mean, me personally, it was what the heck? Like, why? It's I love the fact that it makes no sense. It was somebody's weird idea that they put through and just said, yes, I want to do this. And I'm sure at some point people were going like, you mean you want gators? You want gators and a moat. Okay, yeah.
I got to interrupt you and ask you to elaborate for those who are unfamiliar. Dante's genuinely had alligators, correct?
Yes. Or I think they were caiman, but yes. They had little alligators in a moat next to a pirate ship that you could see. Yeah, it was insane. I love any story of any business or any establishment or band or anything for that matter that you know during its formation, people going like, what are you doing? That's not going to work. That's crazy. Like, what are you thinking? Like, you know, why are you doing it that way? And he just did. And it became this like iconic place that just like in defiance of logic worked, you know, and for the same reason, when we were like painting the walls at MJQ over here underneath this like weird old parking lot, you know, that made no sense. Like, we heard the same thing. Like, why are you, that's like, what are you doing? You're crazy. That's not going to work. Like, this makes no sense. So going down there, I just saw that, you know, the potential of like, oh yeah, this is the new home for weird, you know, this is the new home for the misfits. This is the new home for, you know, people that come in that like, will get it, you know, I'm super excited about that. I was excited when I saw the place.
That's so cool. Do you have any plans for the old decor? Is there anything that's still intact that you would want to incorporate into MJQ?
I mean, a lot of it is intact. I mean, that place is
surprisingly
it's
good
a
shape.
Sealed time capsule yeah. right now. I mean, the ship is still there. Yes, there was a actual pirate ship, sea ship, whatever you want to call it, inside of this crazy space. I mean, I had heard of Dante's, and I had never gone there before I moved to Atlanta. And you, when you're already on the lower level of underground, like when it's closed up, but you don't think anything of it, you open this little like almost like half caboose and slide back the top of it, and you're walking down it like some subway stairs. And when you get to the bottom, you're essentially walking onto, the best way to describe it is like a pier, mm-hmm. a pier that this ship is docked at. And on this pier, there is a bar. And so, wow. And so, you know, like, which is really neat, because if you think about, you know, this ship is docked at this pier, well, you know, if you look in that in another way, you know, is that a plane is docked at a concourse. So it was perfect. I mean, we finally get to, you know, I mean, we get to really lean into the concourse aspect of MJQ and have this almost type of docking bay for this, you know, ship. And you're grabbing a drink and dancing while you're waiting on this thing to take off, kind of thing. And there are some elements that are there that we'd like to hold on to. Obviously, the ship will stay there. The bar will stay there.
Excellent.
A lot of the structure in itself will stay there. It'll be updated to kind of fit our aesthetic, as you know, we're MJQ is not a bunch of buccaneers running around. No. So but a lot of it, yes, a lot of it will, you know, if you had gone there before, the structure and a lot of the bones and everything will still be there and just be skinned slightly different.
Well, I am so happy for you guys. And to close out, I'll just ask you, do you have a potential opening date in mind?
As of right now, our goals are to open up as early as late 2023, but no later than early 2024.
MJQ Concourse co-owners Ryan Purcell and Murphy. More information about their upcoming move to Underground's old Dante's Down the Hatch space is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. It's time now for our series, Speaking of Music, where we hear from Atlanta musicians in their own words.
Hi, my name is Randy Michael from the band Solid State Radio. I would describe our music as cinematic pop, very romantic, a lot of lyrical dissonance. You know, I used to, when I would listen to records, especially like, you know, Eno or Bowie records, you'd always think, you know, the record is like a film, the songs are the scene, and the band or singer, well, that's the star or the actor in that particular role. I got started in music in 1996 when I was about 10 years old. Begged my mom and pop for a guitar, didn't get it, and I ended up getting it from a classmate in my fourth grade class. She gave me her brother's guitar, and I am forever grateful. Ready, steady, go. story of Ready, Steady, Go. Quite simple. That's what happens when your good girl goes and you stay at the pub way too long in the daytime. And you come home and you're hammered and you watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High and you write this little poetic drivel and you get your 2 minute or 3 minute pop song out of it. Inspires me as a songwriter are really, really good lyricists. Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Alex Turner, Mark Knopfler, Phil Lynott, guys that make you close your eyes and you can picture everything that's going on and you're immediately on their side, whether they're right or wrong. New York Calls is a whole different thing. As I said before, I really like cinematic pop. And I wanted to do something that was very, Goodfellas, Phil Spector, Christmas, sleigh bells. I just like to paint audio pictures, really. So you can listen to it in headphones and close your eyes and sort of put yourself in that scene.
Of Solid State Radio. The band's new album, You Gotta Wear It or Let It Go, is now available on all streaming services, and their next Atlanta show is at the Star Bar on April 4th. In a moment, photographer Toki Rome Taylor discusses her work's themes of time, spirituality, visibility, and identity. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Kim Drobes, in for Lois Reitzes, and it is great to have you along. The photos of Atlanta-based artist Toki Rome Taylor reveal themes of time, spirituality, visibility, and identity. Her work largely centers on portraits of African-American children and has been shown in museums around the United States as well as abroad. Her new exhibition, Insight, The Body as Artifact, Archive, and Memory, is on view through April 2nd at the Hammond's House Museum. When City Lights host Lois Reitzes recently spoke with Toki Rome Taylor, the artist explained why photography is her preferred medium.
Lois, thank you. I just want to say we have been listening to you and your wonderful voice for years, and my kids are really excited that mommy is now going to be talking to Lois Reitzes. So I just wanted to share that little warm moment with you. Yes.
Oh, thank you. Well, the honor is mine as well. I mean, you are the artist with works on the walls of major museums.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And I know you are a dedicated art educator as well as a practicing artist. Toki, why is photography your preferred medium?
So for me, photography is that medium that when people initially hear the word photography, they feel like it is accessible. They kind of know what to expect because in this time, everybody has the ability to create a photograph, right? But for me, the photograph actually is more along the lines of paint. The same way a painter would go and purchase a tube of paint, the photograph for me is that raw medium for me to create with. Photography, particularly in its depiction of people from the African diaspora in the United States, has this strange history of photographers capturing African Americans, but then it being used as propaganda. And it has shown us in a negative light in history. And so when I decided I was going to create for me and communicate a message, photography was the go-to medium because I wanted to change or at least become a part of a different narrative with photography.
And how do you counter that narrative of the negative or inferior historical depiction?
Children are the subjects that I use within all of the works that I create. I choose children very deliberately. Children show up in the world as blank slates. What they see, hear, and experience shapes who they are. And I can remember going to the High Museum of Art when I was a child. I'm from Atlanta. When I was a child and I did not see any images in the space that I could connect with, that resonated with me, that made me feel like this space was a place for me. And so there's the subconscious narrative. It's not something you say to yourself deliberately, but there's this self-consciousness, subconscious thought that you don't belong in a space or place when you don't see yourself. And so my goal has always been from the very beginning to center children in an elevated, empowered light so that they can see themselves in museum spaces, in institutional spaces. So for example, I took my students to the High Museum. They now have artworks on the wall that reflect those students. When I took my students to the Hammond's House, because it is a part of Atlanta Public Schools cultural affairs experience, I had the pleasure of showing them works that were created by their teacher. And they were blown away with the fact that, oh, wait, quote marks, you don't just teach art, Miss Taylor. I was like, no, guys, I told you, everything I try to teach you, I also practice it myself. And so it became this wonderful real life experience where these students had the opportunity to see a working artist who was also their instructor and what that working artist does outside of the classroom. And so that was a beautiful experience for them. And that helps shape their narrative and understanding that if I want to be a working artist, I see my teacher doing it. I see her out here putting in the work, doing the research that is required, and communicating a message that resonates. And so I feel like that's a part of my work as well.
Let's talk about that historical research that informs your work. Would you tell us something about the ethnography as well?
Yes, yes. So I'm very big on reading articles. My go-to source is JSTOR. JSTOR is this web-based archive of college, university journals and articles that individuals have written and published, and they've been now digitized. But it gives me the opportunity in one location to research history in the South. I also incorporate the stories from the sitters. I incorporate their family stories. I incorporate their family artifacts. And a lot of times when I speak to them, they say, oh, Toki, we don't have any family artifacts. I said, well, tell me your family story. Or who has been the holder of family story in your particular family? And so then we start this conversation and dialogue. And what they have identified over and over again is, wait, so-and-so does have this item from great-great-grandpa, or they have this item from a distant relative. And then they reach out to that relative. And what happens is they identify that family artifact that can then be the holder of the family story. Because for me, an artifact holds the memory and the story, right? And so they have this opportunity, if they did not already have an identified family artifact or family heirloom, to create one and then start passing that down to their family. And then within the artwork itself, the family artifact is incorporated in the images that I create. So it's really one of those things that when you think of the concept, you have no idea where the concept will take you and the impact that it will have. And what I have seen is that these individuals have started thinking about their family history. They've started thinking about archiving their family's history, generating artifacts for that family history, and carrying on the legacy for that next generation.
Mm. Yeah. Would you talk about the decorative elements you yes. use to add texture for your photos? Some yes, beautiful yes. ornamental touches.
Thank you. So if you look at the works, you will see tons and tons of layering. A part of my process is the layering, not just of fabrics. I use lots of velvets and lace, but also the layering of beads, buttons. You'll see books that are incorporated within the scene. You'll see like these old binoculars. You'll see cowrie shells. And so that comes from a tradition of adornment. Throughout the history of Africans in the diaspora, there is a love of adornment. And so that love of adornment gets incorporated within the works through the layering of the beads, the buttons, the jewelry, and these rich fabrics that I incorporate. Everything you see within the work has a meaning to it. So for example, you'll see the young ladies wearing pearls. And for me, the symbolic meaning of the pearls is that these are items that you would see in the West as an example of wealth and status, right? However, if these individuals were in Africa, they would have African beads. The pearls also make me think back to this journey that we've been on across the ocean and across this huge body of water, and pearls are sourced from that huge body of water. So there's these little touch points within each piece of the work that create a visual dialogue for me.
Hmm. And how does your work restore the self-image lost by African descendants and stand in direct defiance of that erasure?
So when I started doing the research and I was looking throughout this historical canon of depictions of Africans within artwork, what I would see in these paintings from the 1600s, 1700s, and whatnot, I would see people who were Black, but they were utilized within the works as a status symbol of the person who commissioned the work. It would be the status symbol that they had wealth. It would be used as shadow. They are simply there to show that this person who has commissioned the work has wealth. I have Venetian glass. I have this exotic fruit from a foreign land. And I also have this Moor from the foreign land. They are never there as the subject to be focused on and elevated. And so I never would want that to be the narrative of what my children see or the children that I teach or this next generation. I would never want that to be the sole narrative. And so my work stands in direct defiance of that. All of these individuals I have created push into the past. It's not an actual past. It is a past that I have imagined where my subjects are the center. They are the focus. They are there as the person who is valued. And what they are surrounded with are legacies of their culture, of their spiritual practice, and their familiar connections. When I am incorporating those family artifacts, it is a touch point to their family's history. It is also a touch point to their ancestors. When I'm incorporating the objects that I have denoted to be artifacts, it's a touch point for me to connect back to the research that I've done. You'll see buttons used a lot in the work, the mother of pearl buttons. And the mother of pearl buttons were one of those items that within my research just kept coming up. For example, at the Hermitage plantation, they would find in the corners of homes where formerly enslaved individuals lived, they would find these buttons, little pieces of metal and bone. And the ethnographer's speculation, as well as myself, the speculation was this was a continuation of their spiritual practice. And so with that being said, I have to imagine, why are we doing this? What is the power within that? And for me, the power within that is these are individuals who did not have control of their bodies. They did not have control of their children. They did not have control of any of their regular movements. However, through their continued spiritual practice, they could have some sort of power over these other individuals who were controlling them, at least in the spiritual plane. And so that is the power of buttons for me within the work. They're power symbols, a way to have control and power within the space.
Why is the Canon R5 digital camera your camera of choice, Toki? You have acknowledged this.
It is my baby. Like, I saved and thrift for that baby. So I love the Canon R5. And to be honest, for other photographers who are out there, the camera that you have is the best camera that you should be using. So whatever camera you have, that's the best camera, real talk. However, for me, I love the Canon R5 because I love to work big. And so what it really allows me to do is to create images that are large in scale. It also has a touch screen on the back, so I don't have to worry about, with the older cameras, you have to do a back button focus. I'm getting technical, I apologize, but you have to do like a back button focus. But with the Canon R5, you can just tap the screen and have it focus where you need to focus. But really, it's because I can work large with the files. That's my true love.
If listeners are to visit Hammond's house to see your show, those who haven't been there yet, is there one or are there a couple of works you especially want people to note? Would you describe them for us?
Oh, this is a trick question. Oh, Lois, this is a trick question.
Oh, I know. It's like asking which is your favorite lung.
Yes, I need them all, right? So I don't really have a favorite, right? But I will say that the Blue Room, which is what it's been called by most people, it is an installation space in the back part of Hammond's house. And it is composed of works that are, it's a process called cyanotype. And cyanotype is where you create the image through, it's a very, very old image making process that blueprint, like if you created a blueprint, and they call it blueprinting, where you're coating the surface with a UV or light sensitive chemical, and you put your negative on top and you expose it to the sun. And that is how you create the actual image, through removing the negative and washing it clean. I love the cyanotype process because for me, it harkens back to this whole notion of history for me. When you wash a cyanotype, only the stuff that is important to you remains. And so that kind of connects me to this notion of history and how we hold on to what's important. Whatever we want to hold on to, that is what will remain. And so the cyanotype room has these large scale cyanotypes that are layered. There's like four or five different layered cyanotypes hanging from the ceiling. They're not against the wall or anything. They're on cotton. And they're 24 by 90 inches and 24 by 60. Like, they're huge. And they're a combination of cotton and silk layers. And also within the room, the entire floor is covered in cyanotype, giving you this illusion that you're stepping into water. There's these little vignettes within the space where offerings have been set up for ancestors with the incorporation of the buttons and the incorporation of the cowrie shells. I've also got two collaborative pieces within the space that I worked with my twin sister and artist, Sashi Rome. And so it's this beautiful encompassing space that gives you a different experience from the other part of the Hammond's house, because the other part, they are framed works. But then you walk into the blue room and you are walking into this entire space that surrounds you with the cyanotype blue work.
Oh, so effective. Toki Rome Taylor, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you, Lois. I really appreciate the conversation. And like I said, my kids are going to be quite excited.
Atlanta-based photographer and educator Toki Rome Taylor speaking with City Lights host Lois Reitzes. Insight, the Body as Artifact, Archive, and Memory is on view through April 2nd at the Hammond's House Museum. More information is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, we'll share a laugh with Atlanta comedian Mike Schatz. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Kim Droves, in for Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. It's time now for our series, Speaking of Comedy, where local comedians share stories and inspiration from the small stage.
Hey, my name is Mike Schatz, and I'm an Atlanta-based comedian living in Little Five Points, Atlanta. So I knew I wanted to be a comedian, I think, from a really young age. I used to listen to so many different comedy albums of Eddie Murphy, Steve Martin, Billy Crystal. I just memorized all of them. And I loved Jack Benny for some reason. He was before my time, but I thought his humor and his delivery was just so amazing. Some of my earliest memories are sitting at the end of my parents' bed, watching the early days of Saturday Night Live with John Belushi and Jane Curtin, Gilda Radner, Bill Murray, and just thinking that was what I wanted to do. When I got out of college, I actually went up to Chicago to join Second City, and I got a little scared by the city and came back home to Atlanta. And that's where I got involved taking improv classes and starting to do stand-up around town and doing voiceovers, actually. And that's really where my career kind of took off. I think a lot of the challenges for me in getting into comedy and building a career as an actor and a voiceover actor and a comedian was really, you just have to be persistent. I know it's cliched, but you have to stay with it. As a voice actor, I would do hundreds of auditions, and I just got to a point where I was like, I did my best, and if I didn't get it, I didn't get it. As a stand-up, you just have to be willing to go to every single place you can find to perform and be willing to sit there and wait and wait and wait, hope your name gets called. And if it's not, you got to go back the next night. And from an improv standpoint, for me, it was really about getting comfortable on stage, getting comfortable with the speed of improv. And the great thing about that in particular is you learn how to fail. You have to keep the show going, so you can't sit in a joke that bombed. You've got to move on to the next thing. And the nice thing about it is, if people had enough drinks, they don't remember the bad joke anyway.
Here we go. An old lover came knocking on my door. She said to me, baby, I can't wait no more. Next thing I know, we were sharing a cigarette lying on the floor. She was twice my age, and I'm 44. And 44. I said, next time, lover, don't you hesitate. The thing I love about you most is that you're never late. Think about that. Give me a song, wheels. I could be your hot babe. She was in the end. Oh, lover, that's so easy to please. And they don't have good memories.
So the song I shared is called Old Lovers, and it's one of a number of songs that I've written over the years that are kind of dirty songs, but if you didn't know what they mean, they're just kind of beautiful country and folk songs. Old Lovers is actually based on Still Crazy After All These Years by Paul Simon, but it definitely takes its own twisted turn. So I think the thing I've really enjoyed over the years about being a comedian in Atlanta is, you know, even before people came down to from New York and came in from LA to shoot their shows and movies, there's just an energy behind the creativity. Everything from Adult Swim to improv groups that were popping up all around the city, you know, and the stand-up scene's always been really cool. I've had a chance to kind of play in each of those spaces. And I think that there's a diversity there. I think there's a collaborative spirit. I think, you know, I don't think people came from it as underdogs as much as just, hey, this is what I do. And there was always been a sense of like, yeah, let's do it. And so I think it's a big part of not just the comedy scene, but the art scene in general. And I've really been proud of Dad's Garage for really expanding on that and making that the centerpiece of what that theater is all about. Some of my favorite venues around Atlanta to perform in, you know, they range from Eddie's Attic, which is so great to its musicians. No matter what level of musician you are, there's a lot of respect for what you do, and there's a real focus on listening. I am very sentimental about the shows I used to do at Manuel's Tavern and the improv that I did when I was first starting out. I think Laughing Skull Lounge is great. But my home base is really Dad's Garage Theater, where I've had the opportunity to do things that I never thought I would do, from writing a musical about the King of Pops to doing two plays that I had produced to performing with comedians who were the reason that I got into comedy in the first place, everyone from Scott Adsit to Colin Mochrie and Kevin McDonald. And it's just been incredible there. And at the same time, you know, the fact that so many of those people are my closest friends now has just been an incredible part of my life. Primarily, as an improv actor, the crowd is involved in my sets because the show doesn't go on without them and their participation. But as far as other things go, like playing my comedy songs, I really do have fun kind of... you know, whereas most concerts people sing along because they want to, I actually make them sing along, whether they like it or not. And that's just a part of the act. So I don't have any album out yet, but I have been working on a live comedy album over the years. It's a collection of all the ridiculous songs I've written. It's called Dirty Songs for Clean People. And hopefully that'll be in stores one day, if stores exist by the time I finish it. You can also find me as a voice actor on a lot of cartoons, everything from Aqua Teen Hunger Force to one very early episode of Archer. of course, I've met Dad's Garage, where, you know, coming out of the pandemic, now that we've opened up a little bit more, we're doing shows Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And I'm sure if you come see enough shows, you'll catch me in one.
Comedian Mike Schatz and our series, Speaking of Comedy. More information about Schatz, as well as our entire Speaking of series, is on our website, wabe.org/speakingof. The annual German-style arts festival, Goethe Frühlingfest, is this Saturday, March 18th in downtown Avondale Estates. Frühlingfests are traditionally celebrated all over Germany during the spring season. Avondale Estates Frühlingfest exhibits local artists, traditional German dishes, and an opportunity to learn more about the culture. Goethezentrum Atlanta, the nonprofit organization that promotes Germanic language and culture, is the sponsor of the festival. You can find out more information about the festival on their website, goethefrühlingfest.com. That's GOETHEFRUHLINGS fest.com. You've been listening to City Lights on WABE, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., the renowned tenor Lawrence Brownlee joins us to discuss his new song cycle, Rising, ahead of his performance at Emory University's Schwartz Center this Friday, March 17th. If you missed part of today's show, like my earlier conversation with the co-owners of MJQ Concourse about their upcoming move to Underground Atlanta, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights executive producer and host is Lois Reitzes. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Enner, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm City Lights senior producer Kim Drobes, and we would love for you to connect with City Lights on social media. We are at WABE City Lights on both Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.